So tonight's topic and speaker are of great interest to us all. AIDS is, of course, the great health and cultural issue of our time. And tonight we have Dr. Bill Fisher, who's a national and international figure in AIDS research, to speak to us on reducing the risk, understanding and promoting AIDS preventive behavior. He is a professor of psychology at the University of Western Ontario. He's also an honorary lecturer in obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Western Ontario. He did his undergraduate work in the University of Tel Aviv and his postgraduate at Purdue. And before I start to tell you about his career and all the exalted things that I have to tell you about what he's done, I wanted to let you know that Bill says that his high school career counselor would just be amazed to see him here giving this talk, because he was seen to be the person you'd most likely meet in jail. So I guess he knows some things about changing behavior. He is a fellow of the Society of Scientific Study of Sex. He is on the board of Planned Parenthood. He has many awards for excellence in teaching, departmental awards, university awards, and provincial awards. He was co-investigator on a very large health and welfare project, which looked into understanding STD and AIDS risk behavior in adolescents. And he was telling me that it's not so much a project as health and welfare gives you a large amount of money and says, just please spend your time doing research and thinking about this issue. He's currently the co-director of the National Institute of Health Risk Reduction Intervention Project. So we have with us tonight somebody who is preeminent in his field. Please welcome Dr. Bill Fisher.
Good evening, everybody. Can everybody hear okay? I was told to verify that in this great hall of ours that the volume goes through. It's an absolute delight to be here tonight for a number of reasons. It's a delight to meet new friends on the West Coast and to reconnect with old friends and research colleagues. And it's a delight, in a sense, to talk about a very, very important project, a very important social and health problem that it's been my privilege to be involved with as a researcher. I should start tonight's talk with a low-key caveat. I'm going to be talking in a generic kind of way about psychological factors that seem to drive AIDS risk behavior. I'm not going to be able, in the space of 50 minutes, to spend a huge amount of time talking about any particular group of people at risk, but I'll try to touch on most of them and to pick up particular questions during question time. I'd also like to start with a caveat that although I have numbers galore, and I could stultify you from here to kingdom come with structural equation models and proportions of variances accounted for, I'll try to limit my fetish for numbers just a little bit. Now, let's see, is the person in the back listening? If the technician is listening and it's possible to get a slightly bigger image, it would be nice, because there are cameo appearances by all 67 Academy Award winners in various places in the slides, and you're not going to be able to see it. Maybe you could. Okay. The title of the talk is Reducing the Risk, Understanding and Promoting AIDS Preventive Behavior. Indeed, I think my high school guidance counselors would be chagrined. It was slightly inaccurate. They didn't expect me to be in jail. They voted me as most likely in my high school class to die in the gutter, I believe it was. But now, the problem that all of us are confronting, wherever we come from and whatever we do, is a problem that is very simply expressed and a problem that you don't need a PhD in anything to comprehend. The problem is the problem of sexual abandon and sexual activity and HIV roulette. There are a number of statistical breakdowns. Some of the very finest ones originate in Canada, the Gay Men's Study and the Canada Youth and AIDS Study, which my associate Bill Bowie and many others worked on. And these databases give you chapter and verse information that simply suggest that AIDS preventive behavior is still too inconsistent. It's more inconsistent than we would like. It is particularly inconsistent among the great heterosexually active public, but it's somewhat inconsistent even among groups of people who've been hit hard by AIDS and who've made probably the world's most profound behavior changes in the last number of years. Now, there are any number of ways of inferring what the nature of the problem is and concluding that it is a continuing problem. We have a continuing incidence of unplanned teenage pregnancy in our country, and that is the result of the same sort of unprotected intercourse that poses risk of HIV and other STD infections. We have more or less an epidemic levels of various STD in the country, including human papillomavirus infection, chlamydial infections, etc. And we know that unprotected intercourse is taking place for that reason as well. And finally, we have the very sound epidemiological AIDS research charting risk behavior and relatively inconsistent preventive behavior, the sources that I mentioned earlier. Now, when I get nervous as a scientist, I theorize. Okay, other people do other things. But 8 or 10 years ago, together with Jeff Fisher, my brother and partner in crime and co-investigator, we put together a simple, straightforward model that tried to describe psychological factors resident in people's heads that seem to drive AIDS risk behavior. Now, we argued, first of all, that information about AIDS transmission and AIDS prevention is a very, very important factor that either drives or frustrates preventive behavior. But of course, all of us are bright enough to know that even an informed person may or may not be motivated to act on what they know about transmission and prevention. And it seemed particularly important in the light of the abject failure of the multiple information-only education programs that abound to include in our understanding of AIDS preventive behavior the notion that people have to be motivated to practice prevention no matter how well informed. And in addition to information and motivation, it seemed critical to us to hone the particular behavioral skills involved in this two-person dance called preventive behavior, ranging from acknowledging the possibility that tonight might be the night or this month might be the month that I become sexually intimate with a new partner, all the way through the business of negotiating safer sex, using effective one-liners in the sexual clinch, etc. So the model that I'm going to drive tonight's discussion with simply argues that information about AIDS transmission and prevention, motivation to act on what you know, and behavioral skills for the effective practice of prevention are critical elements in AIDS preventive behavior. And I'd like to explore a bit each parameter of the model. The first topic I'd like to unpack is the topic of information and AIDS preventive behavior. Now, when I first got to the AIDS prevention area as an ivory tower or ivory foxhole scientist, I believed that everyone walking around the planet already knows everything they could conceivably need to know about AIDS transmission and AIDS prevention. And if you stacked up all of the various well-made brochures, one on top of the other, and dropped it on the next passerby, that person would suffer serious internal injuries. But upon analysis over the years, I've come to the conclusion that we really need a second generation of AIDS information to really equip people with the specific, easy to translate into behavior information that they, I believe, still require. Now, let's pretend for a moment that we're auditing AIDS prevention in the world. The first auditing criterion that I would urge you to attend to is whether or not the information that is so widely presented is in fact irrelevant to the behavior and preventive needs of the audience. Here we have one of 11 transparencies from a Metro Toronto area school system, which somehow feels that one of the most important things that grade 10 students must know about HIV involves a fundamental understanding of the normal action of the immune system. Immunology is nice, but it is of little benefit if you're out on a date. The first auditing criterion that I would urge you to consider with a relatively vicious zeal, such as I've developed over the years, is this information likely to be easy to translate into the target audience's pattern of preventive behavior? And this kind of information is irrelevant. Much AIDS information that is out there is irrelevant, and it's long past time where we can tolerate that. Once we get through with irrelevant AIDS information, many of us feel perfectly comfortable communicating incomprehensible AIDS information that nobody can possibly understand. You of course comprehend that this is, from a political standpoint, very safe. It's very safe to tell people things that they can't use and things that they can't comprehend. That's fine, and you probably will not be fired by District Number 8 for pandering to the irrelevant or the incomprehensible. But as we audit the AIDS information array available, we have to verify that it is not only easy to translate into behavior and relevant, but also easy to understand. After auditing for incomprehensibility and irrelevance, we ought to audit for scary AIDS information. This is an invitation to explore the delights of sexuality and romance, directed at young people, and intended to alarm them with the truism that roses have thorns. There is a role for fear appeal. There is a definite role for increasing perceived vulnerability, particularly among those who feel invulnerable to HIV, but it is only acceptable if you yoke fear appeals to easy to translate into behavior, efficacious recommendations for prevention. Another thing that occasionally is observed after we cross the irrelevant and the incomprehensible and the scary is that AIDS information sometimes is a bit sexist. In fact, we have danced around the issue of exhorting women to use condoms for so many years that I wondered whether I missed something in my anatomy class and whether, in fact, I had been misinformed as to who has the anatomy that needs to use a condom. Of course it's important, of course it's critical for both sexes to be very active and very assertive and very responsible, but it's almost a left-handed slap in the face to men to implicitly see them depicted as individuals being dragged through life by a raging erection and only able to use a condom if somebody else puts it on them. After the irrelevant and the incomprehensible and the scary and the sexist, we come to dangerous AIDS information. Perhaps the most notable example of dangerous AIDS information was the famous Cosmo cover story in 1988, telling most women that they were safe from HIV infection, a topic that will no doubt be of significant interest to the 65% of the heterosexual people living with HIV infection in Canada, who indeed are women. And finally, after the irrelevant and the incomprehensible and the scary and the sexist and the dangerous, we have met the enemy, and he and she is us, as Pogo used to say. Healthcare providers and health educators, with the best of intentions and the worst of intuition, have provided considerable dangerous information that has fueled AIDS risk behavior. From the perspectives of, let's say, the high school students who I've been busily talking to in focus groups over the years, this is what we say and this is what we get. Lots and lots of young people all over Canada, all over the United States, hear us saying that we should have fewer partners. Fewer partners will make you safe from HIV infection. Now, young people in particular are absolutely delighted to hear that if they only have a few partners, they're going to be relatively safe. And they're even more delighted because upon reflection, they only have one partner, so they must be totally safe. What they fail to comprehend is that most young people in North America engage in a pattern that has been labeled serial monogamy, where one faithful, loving, sure to end in marriage, kids in the suburbs or whatever, relationship ends at Christmas, and then a new one starts, and then a new one starts in the summer, and you stack these relationships end on end, and you have significant risk of HIV and every other STD. One partner is a safe partner, is a bit of information that we have to jettison, because other than in a population epidemiology sense, is not an effective prevention strategy. One lifetime partner would be, but not one partner at a time. A second bit of information we have been providing is that it's wise to get to know your partner. Now, this is kind of interesting. It implies that HIV is a personality trait, and if you scope out your partner, you can avoid it. In fact, in groups of gay men and in groups of high school students that we've had in our research and focus groups and in questionnaire and other research, we find that there has developed, maybe there was always, what I call an implicit theory of risk and personality. And the idea is that you can surveil your partner's external characteristics and determine whether there's any need to use a condom or engage in other HIV preventive behaviors. There's kind of an information heuristic which clicks in a decision rule, and people will say, well, if I have one partner, I'm safe. And there's an implicit personality theory of risk that we, as health professionals, have been responsible for creating in part, and it says that known partners are safe partners, resulting in the familiar pattern of condom use until you get to know your partner. Finally, the message, at least to heterosexual unmarried people for a decade and more, has been don't get pregnant. And people are increasingly heeding this message, although we have roughly 35,000 pregnant teenagers a year in Canada, that's fewer than there were 10 years ago. And the modal pattern of contraception in Canada for young people is first you use nothing, then you use barrier methods, and when you really straighten up and fly right and do the mature thing, you begin using oral contraceptive pills, which is wonderful for pregnancy prevention, and with more than a little irony, the kiss of death when it comes to HIV and STD. Together with colleagues, some of whom are in the room tonight, we've done research on what happens, and it appears that when an oral contraceptive pill prescription is written, a very, very, very large majority of people quit using condoms, and their STD rates climb dramatically. So in part, we have to look inward and determine when our healthcare provision is creating unintended illness. Now, let's say for the sake of argument that we were running things, and everybody that we touched in one way or another had easy to understand and easy to translate into preventive behavior in their life space information. That still begs the question of whether people would be motivated to practice prevention. There are a couple of key factors emerging from our research which seem to determine whether or not people have the motivation to enact that which they know about AIDS prevention. The first motivator or inhibitor of AIDS preventive behavior involves feelings, general feelings about sex, something that I termed 12 years ago erotophobia, erotophilia. Being relatively relaxed or relatively anxious about sexuality has important implications for AIDS preventive behavior. Now, as this sex unspecified, joyously self-stimulating infant suggests, many people come factory wired with a good ability to be erotophilic and to have innate, pleasurable, positive feelings about sexuality. It's my belief, although I can't prove it, that that's more or less a state of original sexual bliss. And as a society, we're kind of schizophrenic. We're very, very, very concerned, as properly we ought to be, about childhood sexual abuse. But by the same token, we want to get our kids sexually active and in the groove as early as we can. And I snuck down to a church basement and took this picture of a group of 11-year-olds practicing some of the heterosexual rituals of our time with a bunch of smiling, happy parents in the background, convinced that their kids were going to get it right. So there are positive feelings that we engender as a society about sexuality. And then with or without society, there is a neuroendocrine event in adolescence called testosterone poisoning. All by themselves, adolescents seem to become very, very sex positive, very, very erotophilic during adolescence. Of course, we impose high school and trade school and college and university on that, and it's not appropriate for them to be sexually active, but from a biologic perspective, they are. So we've got this quantum of sexual positivity driving sexual activity, but there are also bits and pieces of erotophobia. Now, this is actually a photograph of my high school guidance counselor who came to my grade 11 class to tell us about sexuality. And the clinically sophisticated among you will note what psychologists call leaky nonverbal cues. He was inculcating a bit of erotophobia, which was reinforced by other agents of socialization and authority. And the bottom line is that from an emotional perspective, a tremendous number of young people of all sexual orientations are moderately erotophobic and moderately erotophilic, trapped in the middle with positive feelings and negative feelings. And the translation is that many young people for much of adolescence, and for long beyond in many cases, are just relaxed enough about sex to do it, but far too uptight to plan for prevention in advance. And that's something we have to get beyond in the context of motivating people to act on the information that they have. Oops. Now, in a more focused way than diffuse feelings about sex, attitudes about sex and about prevention can also get in the way. In our society, we have no problem whatsoever engendering exceedingly positive attitudes toward pumping some iron, metaphorically, and the metaphor is not lost. This, by the way, does not come from Hustler, it comes from 17 magazine. As a digression, I would remind you, or I would disclose to you, that one of the more embarrassing activities that I undertake as a sex researcher is buying 17 magazine, because I want to see where the sex research, sex education is really taking place. So in 1993, we are making sure that people have positive attitudes toward pumping some iron. The number of people that have positive attitudes toward wrapping iron in latex before pumping is not quite so considerable. And the issue is, you know, the more positive attitude holds sway. We are normatively driven creatures. We brush our teeth not because someone convinced us to this morning. We put our seatbelt on not because we do a cost-benefit analysis every time before we turn on the ignition. We do it because we do it, because it's automatic, it's become normative in our society. It is also normative in our society to a greater extent to be sexually active than it is to practice prevention. It is a significantly stigmatized behavior in some quarters and at some times to practice prevention, far more stigmatized than it is to be sexually active. It is entirely normative to have sexual contact. It is entirely non-normative to talk about it before you do it. Then there's the issue of perceived vulnerability. Can it happen to me? Well, in some communities that have been hard hit by AIDS, the tragic evidence is incontrovertible. It can happen to me, and behavior has changed dramatically. In other communities where people haven't had the feedback from seeing individuals just like themselves develop HIV infection and have to live and die with AIDS, perceived vulnerability is at a low ebb. In fact, in our work with high school students, we have found the sense of invulnerability so difficult to shake that we went out and made a movie called People Like Us. And it involves five heterosexual young people and two homosexual young people, each of whom is just like those in the high school audience, and each of whom has HIV or AIDS. This young woman turns to the camera at the beginning of People Like Us and said, "Nobody told me when I was 15 years old that the guy I was with could give me HIV." There is a role for increasing perceived vulnerability if we can yoke that sense of concern with easy to translate into behavior preventive information. Now, let's assume that we had well-informed people clutching AIDS prevention behavioral scripts. Let us assume that they were motivated to act. In my view, we have been seriously remiss as educators and as healthcare practitioners in failing to address needs for the specific behavioral skills training that goes into the effective, competent practice of AIDS prevention. If we taught driver's education by focusing heavily on the economics of petroleum and the physics of high compression engines, we wouldn't be making any headway in traffic safety. By the same token, there is so much behaviorally irrelevant information that can't be unpacked and practiced that I fear we're doing the same in AIDS education. Now, let's think about this from the perspective of a sexually active individual. From my point of view, there's actually a complicated, partly one-person, partly two-person script that almost anyone would need to know how to enact before they could competently practice AIDS preventive behavior. It is our job as parents, as educators, as citizens, as advocates, as nurses, as doctors, as whomever, to see to it that AIDS education permits people to hit the ground running with the kinds of skills necessary to practice the AIDS prevention behavioral sequence. The first thing that has to happen is people have to emotionally be comfortable enough to accept the fact that they might soon be sexually active and they're in need of prevention planning. The second thing we have to do is assist our patients, our children, our friends, our clients in the creation of an AIDS prevention agenda. Essentially, as I sometimes put it when I'm not too scared to high school audiences, what do you want to do with your genitals for the next 3 years and how do you intend to protect them? We have career counselors, witness the picture earlier, who are entirely comfortable creating a career agenda. What steps will you have to take? What university or other training will you have to take to meet your career goals? we have to run people through the creation of a sexual health and AIDS prevention agenda. In terms of two-person behavior, it's important to be able, with some facility and assertiveness, to engage in a novel form of oral sexual contact called talking about it before you do it. I used to be happier talking about pre-sex negotiation than I am now, because in our intervention research, it's only been a half starter. Some people indeed can look at each other over coffee or over Cokes, and they can say, look, there's a lot of dangerous stuff out there, and we're getting really close, and we really have to talk about these issues. Other people can't. Other people, for one reason or another, are not in a position to do that, and we have to supplement this business of teaching people to negotiate before the sexual clinch, as it were, with one-liners, nonverbal behaviors, things that you can economically use in the sexual clinch. We have to walk people through public sexual health promotion acts, AIDS prevention acts. There's no reason in the world why high school students and in other settings shouldn't be making field trips to pharmacies, interviewing pharmacists, going down to HIV testing clinics, seeking out the views of clergy and parents on engaging in sexual activities but not engaging in sexual intercourse, etc. It's important for us to teach people how to reinforce themselves, how to remember every time they have had protected sex, which can involve not having intercourse, intercourse with condoms, etc., to remind themselves how safe they feel. And to contrast it in their minds with how perhaps unsafe they used to feel. It is also important for us to teach people, for the sake of maintenance of preventive behavior, how to stroke their partners, thank their partner in one way or another for cooperating with a prevention agenda. Critically, we have to teach people how to switch prevention scripts. We have to point out that it is entirely possible to make planful, safe moves from a non-intercourse pattern to a protected intercourse pattern, and we also have to teach people that it is entirely possible and sometimes desirable to make a shift from sexual activity that is protected to non-intercourse activities. Essentially, these behavioral skills haven't adequately been taught, and we must teach the sort of mental and physical thumb wrestling alluded to in this slide. Okay, I would like to just, for the sake of people who are fascinated by numbers, relate that we have tested the information, motivation, behavioral skills model in prospective predictive research with gay men, minority high school students, and college students and university students, and we find that indeed information, motivation, and behavioral skills uniquely play an explanatory and predictive role in driving preventive behavior. Once an empiricist, always an empiricist. From the perspective of the numbers, it accounts for roughly 50% plus of the variability in preventive behavior. I'd like to talk for 5 or 10 minutes concerning suggestions for bringing to bear this understanding, changing information, motivation, and behavioral skills, and realizing increases in preventive behavior. I took a course in university called Audiovisual Aids from Hell, and I'm always punching the wrong button. The first thing that we're concerned with is changing information and promoting AIDS preventive behavior. According to the audit sheet that I offered earlier for your consideration, there are a couple of suggestions that I have. First, AIDS prevention information has to be comprehensive. We have to talk, in essence, to everybody about everything and make no assumptions about the sexual orientation, chemical use, drug use, needle use, etc., of our audience. AIDS prevention information not only has to be comprehensive, it has to be easily translated into a particular target group's preventive behavior in the ecology that they live in. We have to provide instructions, as it were, that can be easily translated into how not to get infected. This kind of information has to be offered in traditional settings, such as school classrooms. It has to be offered in clinical settings routinely, where it is not always offered. It has to be offered in street settings. It has to be offered before it's needed, not after. And it has to be tailored to the sensibilities and needs of a diversity of target groups, ranging from the sensibilities and needs of young gay men to the sensibilities and needs of individuals with physical handicaps, many of whom are perceived as not being in need of this information, et cetera, et cetera. We have to change not only information, but we have to change motivation as well. First, we have to alter feelings. We've gone a long way toward doing so. We have to become accepting enough of sexuality such that each of us becomes a candidate for thinking about and planning prevention. I think the first step in any clinical effort to relax a phobia is to begin to talk about the feared entity in a calm way, and I think we need to do more and more of that. We have to change attitudes. We have to change focused feelings. First, change attitudes toward unprotected intercourse and HIV risk so that they're negative. And then we have to yoke prevention with positive feelings. See dick with an erection, see dick with no protection, see dick with an infection. The good news is that this changes attitudes. It lightens people up and makes people feel a little bit better about it. The bad news is that my intervention program produced 15,000 of these matchbooks and were forbidden from distributing them in a particular place. We have to yoke AIDS prevention to humor. We have to yoke it to trust. And we have to yoke it to lust. We have to eroticize safer sex, even as we stigmatize and make more negative attitudes toward risk. We have to change norms. Part of what we're about as advocates, as educators, and as practitioners, part of what we're about is argument. We have to make a case for change. Part of what we ought to be about is announcing a new norm. Ceasing the argument and simply saying that we do this because it's 1993 and it's awfully silly to do anything else. We have to announce, as this lovely second generation poster announces, that the dress code for the 90s is latex. We have to make it absolutely normative that you never open this before opening this. We have to make it normative, expected, cool, in, that when you get it on with condoms and imagination. This poster was so good that the London, Ontario police force busted the University of Western Ontario library for hanging it. And we have to normalize sexual pickiness, selectivity, not having intercourse always, not necessarily ever, not with everybody. We have to change perceived vulnerability. HIV is very clever. The fundamental law of human behavior change is that people begin modifying their behavior when similar others who do the same thing have terrible things happen to them. Now, we can tell that our friend drank and drove and he got killed in a car accident. Maybe we'll be a little likely to change our behavior. We can tell that our friend did some other dysfunctional pattern of behavior and something terrible happened to her and we'll be more likely to change. But HIV is clever. By the time many individuals start seeing evidence that people just like them, who do just what they do, are becoming HIV infected and affective, it's going to be too late, because the feedback loop takes years and years and years. One of the ways that we can increase perceived vulnerability and bring this home is through devices, educational devices, like the People Like Us video that I spoke of later, where 15-year-olds who do what those in the audience do and get what those in the audience don't want to get become more popular. This is a 15-year-old to whom that happened. This is a young adult male to whom this happened. This is a young black woman to whom this happened. In our pilot research with first-year university students, we were able to track HIV testing as the sole result of seeing this 26 or 28-minute video, and 18% of those in attendance thought it reasonable to get tested and indeed sought testing as a result of this changed vulnerability. One of the students who got tested gave me this lovely quote: "The scariest part is that these people were just like me." But HIV robs us of that, given its natural history. Finally, we have to change behavioral skills to promote AIDS preventive behavior. We have to make certain that if it's called an AIDS prevention education program, people have had an opportunity to consider the fact that they might be sexually active, that people have had an opportunity to construct a personal prevention agenda, and that people have walked through and rehearsed some of the overt behaviors involved in talking about this issue with others, buying condoms discreetly and safely carrying them, exiting unsafe situations is an important behavioral skill, reinforcing their partners, and shifting patterns carefully and planfully and in a protected way. We have a second behavioral skills educational component called, funnily enough, sex, condoms, and videotape, where we walk people, just like those in the audience that it is targeted at, through things like preparing for a date and, in the context, putting a condom in one's pocket. We walk people through pre-sex discussion and negotiation of safer sex and of not having intercourse. We walk people in the sexual clinch through one-liners and through deciding on orgasmic alternatives to insertive sexual activity. We walk people through, in a behavioral script way, exiting situations that are unsafe. Your feet can be a good preventive vehicle. In the context of changing information, motivation, and behavioral skills, we've adopted a very explicit three-phase approach that I'll spend a minute on, and then we'll open it up to questions. In our research approach, the very first phase, without which you're lost, has been termed elicitation research. Elicitation research involves going to the people with whom you wish to deal and having them inform you about what their needs are. Hubris, dragging your knuckles in the ground and saying, "Me scientist, you target population," will not get us too far. What we can do as prevention scientists is understand that information, motivation, and behavioral skills are important. What we must do in the first phase of educational interventions is to go to representative samples of the group you want to work with and elicit or find out what the information gaps might be in that group, what the motivational obstacles in that ecology might be, and ways to get around them, what the specific behavioral skills deficits and strengths that you can capitalize on might be, and what AIDS preventive and AIDS risk behaviors are of most concern in this group. Once you have mapped out information, motivation, behavioral skills, and behavior deficits and strengths, you're in a better position to tailor-make truly useful educational interventions. The second phase, wholly determined by elicitation research, wholly determined by the content of the information, motivation, and behavioral skills discovered in the groups you're working with, involves interventions that are constructed and targeted in a group-specific way to supply some of the information, motivation, and behavioral skills and to capitalize on the strengths that may be available. The third phase, which is sadly lacking, is finding out whether it worked. In an era of economic constraints, and for numerous other reasons, we have to conduct systematic evaluation research to find out if the group-specific intervention has really changed information, motivation, and behavioral skills, and most importantly, behavior. We have conducted randomized experimental research, the first phase of which is now done, using an 8-hour, 3-session intervention in dormitory and residence settings in first and second year university students. We have conducted elicitation research to identify information, motivation, and behavioral skills gaps and strengths, constructed highly specific targeted interventions, and used interactive techniques to convey and communicate and engage the information, motivation, and behavioral skills, and conducted 4-month evaluation research showing promisingly not only sustained increases in information, motivation, and behavioral skills, but sustained increases in condom purchasing, condom use during intercourse, and HIV testing. I also put down one non-result. We specifically did not strongly advocate talking to your partner as an effective preventive measure, and there was no significant increase in that behavior by intention. I will close by reminding us with this old slide from Leave It to Beaver that the kids are no longer out fishing, and the kids, in a sense, are not all right. But we as citizens and as professionals can do a great deal about it, and as scientists, we can try to find effective ways of thinking about the necessary ingredients in AIDS prevention intervention programs and then turning to those with whom we would work for the specific content of those programs. Thank you for your attention, and I guess we'll open it up to questions. Okay, I'm going to repeat the questions for people whose hearing is as bad as mine. The question is a wonderful one and an easy one to answer because I'm ill-informed about it. The question had to do with some relatively recent publications, one of them, The Myth of Heterosexual AIDS, is that the name? And other publications raising the possibility that HIV is not the major causal agent in AIDS. I am entirely a generalist in this area. I have read one of the books and not the other two. My take on the matter is that there is strong evidence that that HIV is the pathogen we ought to be worried about. But more than that, I would direct you to specialists in immunology and virology. I apologize for not knowing that part of the AIDS world, but this is the part of the AIDS world that I know about. And I think it's an important question. And I also would say, as a scientist who has very often been caught short on the most plausible of hypotheses, not to dismiss any hypothesis. Yes?
One of the serious issues now, AIDS in Canada is still significantly homosexual disease. And one of the issues is the emerging gay man who discovered that he's gay. And he's only 16, 17, 18. If you start talking in high school about homosexuality and how the emerging gay man is conducting himself, there's going to be big trouble from parents. And I wonder how you propose to do that.
Okay, the question had to do, There were two parts to the question or comment that I'd like to address. The first in capsule was that HIV and AIDS is still a predominantly homosexual disease in Canada. And the second part was, gee, if we start, in essence, teaching young people how to be gay men in high school, if we start, you know, being very tolerant and providing a lot of guidance, then we're going to have trouble with parents. I'd like to comment on each part of the question separately. The first part of the question I probably would, to a certain extent, disagree with. That involves the supposition that AIDS is predominantly a heterosexual disease in Canada. Right now, in terms of people with clinical AIDS, which is the end of probably a 10-year process of HIV infection, it is true to say that the majority of the AIDS caseload is homosexual men. To what degree HIV is generally incident in the population, we don't really have a terrific idea. We know that one in a couple of thousand women who have babies in Ontario have HIV. Okay, there are little bits of information. Well, in the United States, for example, they've been testing every recruit for military service at the age of 18. They've accumulated 3 million HIV tests, and this is in a organization that until recently actively threw gay people out of it. So it would tend to be a relatively select sample, you know, against gay people. We find, you know, anywhere from 1 in 1,000 to 1 in 100 HIV infections in this 18-year-old population. So I think what we ought to say right now is that it is the case that AIDS, as the end product, if you will, of HIV infection, is presently mostly a homosexual problem in North America. HIV infection is probably much wider than this, and it's going to be all of our problem. I'd also hasten to say that AIDS is a behavioral problem. More of the homosexual men in my research samples are safe from AIDS than the heterosexual men and women that I study. AIDS is a behavioral problem. So those are some stray thoughts on that. Okay, how would you go about conducting AIDS education in a high school setting in a way that would legitimize, in what I regard as a healthy way, differences in sexual orientation without rushing a person into one sexual orientation or another? I think it's an important question. We could be overzealous. We could seize on this 15-year-old who's had one crush on a same-sex other, pat that kid on the back and say, not to worry, being gay, you know, is fine. Here's a book about gay heroes, and I want you to go right down to the homophile organization and sign up and be gay forever. That would be silly at the age of 15 or 16. And I don't believe that's being done. If it's being done, I think we would all agree that it would be silly. By the same token, it is incredibly important to provide some legitimacy to people who have sexual orientations, whether they're heterosexual men or homosexual women or young people. It is awfully lonely. It is awfully scary, I've been told. There is a reasonably high incidence of self-destructive behavior for people who are made to feel that what they are, and not what they chose to be in most cases, but what they are, is illegitimate, sinful, or awful. And that's why we have to strike a middle of the road. Neither one nor the other. And that's what I would, you know, I would favor. And I would think that certainly many people would be tolerant of that middle of the road approach. Yes, sir.
Some of the first suspect that also have chances to become heroes, as it were. So what do you think about that aspect of negative reinforcement?
Okay, the question is, what about, in essence, the concept of shame? What if, and correct me if I'm misreading your question, what if we were prepared to in essence, shame people with AIDS? Is this the line? So, and that would act as a regulatory mechanism, and other people not yet infected would not want to experience the shameful outcome? Is that... I think I think that there are a lot of things that can be said to people who aren't infected with HIV that will be important. I think we need to let people know that they're vulnerable. I think that we need to let people know that there are reasonably low-cost, reasonably doable ways to avoid infection. I don't think shame is going to be an effective, and I know it's not a humane, method of shaping behavior. I think that there are many other methods. Shame did not, I think it becomes at some point a philosophical discussion, but there are so many likely effective methods of changing behavior that, you know, if only for humanitarian reasons, I would not invoke shame. It is also the case that we are dealing with a population that has exceedingly common risk behavior. And the difference between the individual with HIV and the individual without HIV ordinarily is luck. So I have a little difficulty with the shame concept. I think there are many effective, positive ways we can change behavior before we get to shame. Yes? So the question is, what about in dealing with, let's say, adult individuals in their 30s or in their 40s who are perhaps re-entering the arena of relationships? How do you get them to comprehend that this is an important issue? Well, you know, I sometimes when I'm looking at high school classes, I wish I was looking at groups of people in their 30s and their 40s because this bulletproofness that permits people to become hockey goalies at the age of 12 or whatever is absent in the 30 and 40-year-olds. So I think that they have a sense of vulnerability. I think there may be a lot of other agendas. I think if they're fundamentally uncomfortable with being sexual in that way again, it may be hard to get past that. Because if I can't really come to terms with the fact that I'm dating and that dating may have a sexual component, it's going to be very hard for me to plan for prevention. It may also be that part of what you're doing as a therapist with older people is you're re-socializing them. And you may just want to announce rather than persuade that, of course, one of the things you do is you and your partner will, you know, want to both be tested before having intercourse, or you and your partner will both want to, you know, use condoms or something like that. And that may be a relatively low emotion way of introducing this. You know, there are many people that I deal with re-entering the marketplace who have to learn a variety of social skills, you know, ranging from gender tolerance, you know, to not putting out cigarettes in people's ashtrays when they're not really ashtrays and haven't been for 10 years. A question in the back?
Of the partners taking people's blood tests
Okay, I'm not sure I heard all the question. What proportion of the population or okay, what proportion of the population practices zero tolerance? That's a nice phrase. The example given was taking mutual HIV tests and sharing the results. I would also argue that that particular prevention strategy is by no means foolproof, because nice tested couples, you know, go to parties and do things that they didn't expect to do, and you know the test may not, you know, be held up like a cross in front of a vampire and ward off everything. Mutual condom use is another approaching zero tolerance thing. I guess the best answer I could give you is that AIDS prevention in a very careful way is inconsistent. And then you have to cut up the pie and look at where you're looking. If you're looking at first-year university students in Ontario, probably 60% have had unsafe sex within the last year, probably somewhat more. That's 60% of the 80% sexually active. If you're looking at the Gay Men study, a nationwide sample recently published in Canada, it varies across regions, but something like 20% of the men who responded to that study had unprotected anal intercourse under some safer or less safe circumstances, and some of the circumstances differed in their safety during the last several months. So we have a lot of room for improvement. That's the simple answer. Yes? Okay, we're getting much. Okay, let me start out by restating the question. What was the problem with the matchbooks? Okay, they didn't have matches either. They had a condom inside. Let me generalize the question and just speak to the issue of opposition to effective AIDS education. Okay, effective AIDS education is going to be to the point and usable, as I emphasized and as we all emphasized earlier, and that frightens some people because. In the words of one person, in fact, the person who resisted this matchbook campaign, we're trying to teach them to sin with impunity. Okay? And in terms of moralizing, there's a not too subtle undercurrent that you really have to pay for your sins. And there's a lot of fear that if you teach people to be safe, they'll copulate with wild abandon with anything and anyone that moves. Now, this is an old story. It's an old story from those of us who were involved in contraceptive education. And there are two ways to deal with it. The first, from a scientific perspective, deal with it with data. Okay? The first data point I can give you is that most people in the venue where I was forbidden from distributing these things, 80% were already sexually active. Okay? Modally, 70-odd percent without the consistent use of a condom. So, I mean, it can hardly be, inciting sexuality here. Still other data from the contraceptive domain, there's an average of 19 months between first intercourse in Ontario and first use of prescription contraception. Contraception and condoms do not cause sex. Eventually, sex causes the two. So from a scientific perspective, we can put out data that speak to the question. Then we all have to recognize that sexuality education has always been not only a pedagogic, but a political issue. There is a feeling that the status quo is real safe. And what we must convey from the perspective of an epidemiologist or from other scientific perspectives is that the status quo is very dangerous, typically for those who the opposition claims to serve. And we have to do something about that. Okay. This, I'm trying to find a way of not naming. This was a major university not in Canada. Okay?
The
I would say not intimately, but it would sound like a pun. I'm aware of it, but I don't know all the details. In London, Ontario, the question again about, you know, condom distribution, there's another one or two free associations. In London, Ontario, the school community resisted. The student councils took a vote and demanded condom machines. Okay. However, there is a real feeling in many high schools that I consult with that all we have to do is hang those condom machines up and then everyone is safe. My point to them is always that if you do the appropriate education, it is not a technical feat to find your way to a drugstore and buy a condom. Okay? You know, people afford CDs and things, you know, they get them. If you got to choose one of the two, do the education. I'm sorry, yes.
Could you speak briefly to the public policy, public health aspect of this? In terms of public health, AIDS has not been treated in the way that sexually transmitted diseases traditionally were.
The question is, from a public health perspective, HIV and AIDS hasn't been treated as other STD have been treated. There are a lot of sides to this. There is a discussion of contact tracing, which is fairly common in the STD domain. You find out, you know, more or less who gave you this condition and you try to treat them. There are other public health differences as well. Are you talking about a particular one?
Mm-hmm. We said status quo is the easiest way to go.
Yeah.
But in terms of public health, it's precisely the opposite. In terms of privacy, it's
yeah.
And those don't square.
Yeah, the feeling, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm trying to pick up, you know, the core issue here. Sometimes the feeling has been expressed that in essence we're being somewhat hard-nosed about most STD, but altogether too liberal, too tolerant about HIV in terms of public health regulations? Is that the gist of it?
Well, basically, I'm trying to listen to your response to that.
I think we've got to work out, from a regulatory perspective, I'm not talking about sort of public health in terms of disease prevention, contact tracing, et cetera, but in terms of the legislation of AIDS, in terms of the public health legislation that covers AIDS and covers individuals who perhaps infect other individuals, et cetera, much work remains to be done. In London, Ontario, again, where I come from, there was recently a case of an individual who had apparently knowingly infected a number of other individuals, and a trial was conducted. And it raised many, many issues of a public health regulatory nature. And none of those issues were resolved, although many were debated, because the accused died before the end of the trial. One of the issues, I think, was a wish by both Crown and the accused's defense that it be the subject of legislation rather than sort of judicial judgments. But that's about the extent of my expertise in the area, I guess I'd have to say. Okay. Thank you very much.
I'd like to call on Dr. Bill Maurice, who's the co-director of the Sexual Medicine Center at Shaughnessy, about to relocate at VGH, and also an associate professor of psychiatry here at UBC, to thank the speaker on our behalf.
Thank you. I've had the opportunity of hearing Dr. Fisher talk on some other occasions, and I know the intelligence and the humor that he brings to just about any subject that he talks about. There's really very little information on the subject of AIDS prevention, although one hears quite a bit in the media about HIV and AIDS, and I really would like to thank him for not only the elegance of his presentation, but for giving us information about which one hears very little nowadays. Thank you very much.